The man in front of me at the Builder Square checkout put his quart of paint on the counter and tried to make conversation with the clerk. "Good morning, how's it going?" The young guy looked at his customer as if he wondered who in the world could possibly care. And then he muttered the words that became this morning's sermon title. "Yeah, just another day." I didn't know at the moment that I had heard a sermon title, but as I drove home, I kept thinking how sad it would be to feel like that, to dismiss a day as if it meant nothing much, as if there might never be a time when just another day would be the greatest gift one could hope for. I suppose if one of us had asked the clerk what could make a day special, he would have talked about a party coming up in a few weeks, or a better job he hoped to get one of these days. But until then, he was simply marking time. Some of us spend huge hunks of a lifetime just waiting. No nourishing memories from yesterday. Today, dull and drab. But tomorrow, oh, tomorrow the sun will come up like a Sousa March. The air will taste like cool wine, and every golden hour will be better than the one that came before. But until then, boredom. Someone else may see magic in the innocent curiosity of a child, or hear music in the words of a stranger, but we miss it because it's just another day, and our ears are cocked for some far-off music more exotic than the quiet melody of the moment. In the great American comic strip, Peanuts, troublemaking Lucy, who is proud of herself, says one day, "Charlie Brown, I never think about the past. Also, I never worry about the future." It sounds a little smug to Charlie, so he asks, "What about the present?" At which point, Lucy reveals why she is so often unhappy, exploding her frustration in huge block letters, "The present drives me crazy." Too bad, Lucy, because the present is the only gift you can be sure of. The saints and philosophers have told us that over and over through the centuries. Carpe diem, seize the day, enjoy the present, live the moment. I saw a psychological study the other day which suggested that we spend far too much time worrying about what happened yesterday or may happen tomorrow, and far too little acting in the present. There was once a young man named John out with his girlfriend on a lovely moonlit night. He sensed that she would not reject a hug, but he was too shy to make a move, and there came a long, awkward silence. Finally, she thought it might help him if she got a conversation going. So she said, "John, tonight, what would you rather be than anything else in the world?" He thought for a moment and then said, "A great big octopus." She was a little surprised. "Why an octopus?" "Well," he said, pleased with himself, "so I could take all my 25 arms and wrap them around you real tight." She thought to herself, "Well, first of all, an octopus doesn't have 25 arms. So either this guy's an idiot or he's crazy in love." So she decided to challenge him with the present. She said, "Interesting analogy, John. considering the fact that you're not doing anything with the two arms you have. Small children enjoy the present beautifully before something makes them decide that it's not cool to be fully alive in every place and every minute. I'm just back from seeing a 3-year-old grandson named Cass, for whom there is no such thing as just another day. He invites me to take him for a walk, but we never get very far because he stops constantly to examine some new wonder, a silver thread on the sidewalk, which I explain is the signature of a snail, or what I thought was only a mushroom, but he explains is an umbrella for an elf. I envy the delight he finds in the world. But I'm afraid that when he gets to be 11 or 12, he'll agree with his friends that unless he's exactly where he wants to be and doing exactly what he wants to do, he is supposed to wear a look of infinite boredom until something better comes along. The problem is that at that age, he'll have to do all sorts of things he'd rather not be doing, which means he'll waste a lot of valuable time being bored. But he wouldn't have to be, because boredom is a choice. Try to imagine that you are 11 or 12 years old this morning, and your parents have brought you to a strange church when you would have preferred staying at home. What do you do? Well, there are two possibilities. You can be bored until this particular hour is gone forever out of your life, and you can get away. Or since you have to be here, you can save something from it. You can stimulate the marvelous gift called curiosity by noticing anything that's different from where you were this time yesterday. How many lights are there in those chandeliers? And how do people get up there to clean them? How do those organ pipes work? And how many are there back behind the ones I see? And if you were to ask me, I would tell you happily, there are hundreds. Is there some reason why these people chose white pews with walnut caps and clear windows instead of stained glass? There are answers to those questions. Sermons are supposed to give you prescriptions for living, and here is a good one. No matter where you find yourself, look and listen and ask questions. And all of a sudden, instead of being bored, you start to learn things. You can make it happen in church, even when the worst part comes, the part they call the sermon. You can always stay alive by starting a debate inside your head. Do these words I'm hearing make any sense? And do I agree with them or disagree? And why? If I were up there speaking, what would I do to make it more interesting? And suddenly, your imagination is at work, so that instead of wasting 20 minutes, you've exercised your brain and found a way to save yourself from boredom, one of the worst diseases anybody can have. I hope I haven't lost the grown-ups in the last couple of minutes, because what the sermon wants to say this morning is that whether we're 11 or 77, there really ought not to be such a thing as just another day. Poets use words better than preachers. Listen to this one describe the miracle of an ordinary day. I have walked them through, he says, and found the quick surprises of their hours, some lovely, unexpected thing to do. I tread them softly. They are hallowed ground. There are no common days. If you believe those last two sentences, you make a miracle of life. The first one, for example, that the ordinary days we walk through are hallowed ground, sacred and holy, each one of them. You know, we still unconsciously echo the old Anglo-Saxon reverence that gave each day of the week the name of a god or a goddess. Sunandaya, the sun's day. Monandaya, the moon's day. Tuesday, for Tiu, the god of war. Wednesday, for Woden, king of the gods, Woden's day. Thursday, for Thor, the god of thunder. Friday, for Frigga, goddess of love. And Saturday, for the Roman god Saturn. We write it off, of course, as heathen nonsense, but I like the idea that each day is sacred. And then the poet's second sentence, there are no common days. What a difference it would make if we made that an article of faith. If we could say and mean it, this is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice in it and be glad. Tell me why it's not blasphemy if we dismiss such a gift by calling it just another day. If you're ever tempted to do that, to overlook the normal days while you wait for one to be special, you might want to remember one woman's tribute. I have it framed and hanging on the bedroom wall. Normal day, let me be aware of the treasure you are. Let me learn from you, love you, savor you, bless you before you depart. Let me not pass you by in quest of some rare and perfect tomorrow. Let me hold you while I may, for it will not always be so. One day I shall dig my fingers into the earth, or bury my face in the pillow, or stretch myself taut, or raise my hands to the sky and want more than all the world your return. How many normal days pass without our being glad in them, until one day the familiar blessings they bring have vanished? The sense our work gives us of being needed, the friend who seemed forever but moved away and sent letters less and less often until they stopped, the sometimes difficult child who grew up and went away and left a bed behind that stays perfectly made until sometimes you change it just to have something to do. Well, somebody says, it sounds all right, but we're in church. What does it have to do with religion? And my answer is everything. Because it seems a foolish thing to me to marvel at miracles that are 2,000 years old and miss the ones that happen every day. After dinner, a husband looks over the top of his book to smile a quiet declaration of love. A baby takes its first step. A brave woman looks at you in the hospital, smiles through pain and fear, and says, she feels quite well, thank you, and she's glad you came by. A whole universe of miracles so commonplace, we take them for granted. How strange that we should spin tales of a heaven far off and stumble blindly through the only one we can be sure of. So yes, I think this conviction that no day is common has everything to do with religion, that unless each day is a gift from God, hallowed by its own fragile, never-to-be-repeated magic, then our whole profession of faith is a mockery. Some of you may have watched some of those PBS documentaries recently about Stephen Hawking, the famous Cambridge astrophysicist who advanced Einstein's work on relativity and is credited with the mathematical calculations that suggest the evidence of black holes in space. A remarkable man. Dr. Hawking has Lou Gehrig's disease and has been in a wheelchair for years, reduced to a kind of robotic speech generated by his computer. He admits that before he became ill, he was often bored, drank too much, worked too little, but that when he realized he had only a few years left, his life underwent a radical change. Claiming to be happier after his affliction than he was before, he says, "When one's expectations are reduced to zero, one really appreciates everything one has. Suddenly, each day becomes precious and meaningful." There's always someone to wake us up who never had what the rest of us take for granted. No one has said it with more passion or power than Helen Keller, born blind. "I who am blind can give one hint to those who can see, one admonition to those who would make full use of the gift of sight. Use your eyes as if tomorrow you would be stricken blind. And the same for the other senses. Hear the music of voices, the songs of birds, the strains of an orchestra, as if you would be stricken deaf tomorrow. Smell the perfume of flowers. Taste with relish each morsel, as if tomorrow you would never smell and taste again." We know it's good advice, but we quickly forget. Maybe we should have a little sign on the breakfast table. "This is the day which the Lord has made. I will rejoice in it and be glad."